Patriots and the Titans in a second, but first, a couple big plays from last night like this one. Zeke with the handoff over Trey Sullivan on a 32-yard gain.
See, as far as spectacular plays that are happening at a higher rate than any time in NFL history, the one-handed catch by so many guys and the hurdle, I feel like didn't happen nearly as much even 10 years ago as we're seeing right now.
Well, guys are going lower to tackle. They're not headhunting as many guys. So you can tell their helmet's getting ready to come down. So, yeah, this is the thing. That's the only way you can go. Protect your knees, and more open field runners are doing it. You are right.
Beautiful, beautiful jump. The Browns' Nick Chubb bursts through a hole, evades a few tackles, took it 92 yards to the house, longest touchdown run in Cleveland Browns history, boys.
That's a good draft pick by them. Top of the second round, 35th pick. He was excellent yesterday.
It seems like they had to get rid of Hugh and Todd to get him the football.
And now, trade away a guy.
They had to get rid of Hugh, get rid of Todd, trade away Carlos Hyde. Hey, Khalil Mack was back in the lineup for Chicago.
He was good. Fall down.
Shakes the first lines player, flattens the second before getting to Matt Stafford.
Hey, we did a lot of hand-wringing the first 3 weeks of the year about the NFL's new rules protect the quarterback. Defensive players, as they always do, have adjusted. That's that hawk tackle, see? He grabbed it, right? He grabbed him and kind of rolled to the side. Maybe it's not the hawk tackle, but instead of just jumping on his back and falling on him, he twisted. It's what guys want him to do. This is an amazing play.
I'm sitting here I'm trying to figure out what John Gruden couldn't use. He couldn't use the swim. He couldn't use the speed rush, the bull.
A little more from this game. Allen Robinson with a beautiful adjustment to make the touchdown catch.
They spent a lot of money on him this offseason. This was his first monster game of the year. He's had a couple other decent ones, but he was great yesterday.
Bears fans, be a little patient, too. You know he got injured last season. I thought he was the better of the wide receivers.
No doubt.
Cowboys got Allen Hurns. I believe the Bears got it right. Just be patient. Injured last year, around midseason, you could see last night his biggest game for the Bears. You should see plenty of this in the future.
All right, moving on to Tom Brady and the Patriots trying to make it 7 wins in a row. But Marcus Mariota and the Titans would have other plans. Titans jump out to an early 7-3 lead with a touchdown to Jonnu Smith. Later in the quarter, Mariota finds Corey Davis. And Tennessee suddenly up 14-3. Fast forward to the end of the half. Titans up 24-10. Tom Brady gets sacked, one of his 2 sacks on the day, going for the Hail Mary. Brady wouldn't finish the game. Brian Hoyer would have to come in to make matters worse. Julian Edelman left with an injury. Pow, 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 pow. We won the game. Titans blow out New England 34-10. Here's Tom Brady after the loss.
In the NFL, it's hard to win. You can't expect just to show up and win. That doesn't give the other team enough credit. And today we just played a bad game. And, you see what happens. And hopefully there's more urgency as we go forward. And, our whole season's ahead of us. And, we'll see what we do with it.
Yeah, it's a real sweet win, especially when you used to be there and they didn't want to bring you back. So definitely real sweet. I'm happy my teammates came out and played, and I love these guys.
So it is a little personal.
Hell yeah, it's personal. That's what happens when you go cheap. You get your ass kicked.
All right, see, what did last night's loss tell you about the Patriots?
Well, first, Deion's right. Bill Belichick, he does like to go out, but it's going to be a cheap date.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's not in the pan. We see what he does for Tom Brady, so I don't know why these other guys, why they would be offended. You go there, boost your career, then you got to go somewhere else to be able to get the money. But I'm not that surprised by the loss yesterday. And the reason why, and for a number of years, the Tennessee Titans have been a very, very physical football team. I thought Mike Vrabel, the assignment that he got when Tennessee was one of the better coaching for the new coaches taking over last year. They were a playoff team. They are very, very physical. And I thought that his style, absent of Andrew Luck coming back and us knowing if he was going to be healthy with Frank Wright taking over the Colts, I thought this was the best match as far as personality, the type of players, and how they would move forward. Not only that they were a playoff team, so I think Vrabel's done a tremendous job of transitioning. Marcus Mariota had his best game as far as balance, finally got some feeling back in his arm and his hand, which he injured in the first game of the season against the Dolphins. So this was a good football game because they had every opportunity. Tennessee, we played good. Here come the Pats. No, one state, when the Pats answered, Tennessee came right back. And you have to give Matt LaFleur, the offensive coordinator, a lot of people don't know about him. He's very, very creative. If he had the type of talent that Sean McVay, you'd be hearing about his name more often. But you can see when the game was tight, look at the type of plays that they called. Man, Mariota, they used him as a receiver, threw a pass to him in a critical point in the game. So that's what I saw with the Tennessee Titans. I think they're an underrated football team. And you could see what they did to Dallas. F what Dallas did last night to Philadelphia. Look what Tennessee, this week against New England, last week against Dallas. It's hard to be a good football team and be the midway point in the season and play eight good quarters the way the Titans have and not be a good team.
Here's the concern for the Patriots, because this one did surprise me, because they were on a roll. The Titans, I thought, might still be a little happy from what happened this past week. And the one less week to prepare for the Patriots mattered to me, that they had a Monday game and the Patriots obviously didn't. The Pats have been a very bad road team this year.
Yes.
They have now three double-digit road losses. That's more than any other year in the entirety of the year in Belichick's entire tenure.
What do you attribute that to?
Well, before I do that, I just want to make sure the audience knows what those are, because even their wins, they haven't been very impressive on the road. They got blown out by Jacksonville on the road. Jacksonville's not any good. They got blown out by Detroit on the road. Detroit's a mediocre, at best, football team. Chicago, what did they need? Two special teams touchdowns to win that game. Buffalo, that offense was non-existent in that game. They needed a pick six to salt it away and to be playing Peterman, Derek Anderson. I don't even remember who the hell was playing quarterback for them, but it was bad for Buffalo. And then this week at Tennessee. So what do I attribute it to? That right now this is a team that I think is playing over its talent level at home. And on the road, what we say this in the NBA, you say this in the NBA a lot, that role players play one way at home, one way on the road. Yep. I don't know how much that translates to the NFL.
They need the crowd. They need the momentum. And it's just easier for them on the road. Less distractions. Yes, and their talent, that's what it seems like, their talent is not stretched as much as we've seen once they go on the road.
I can't remember a time, and I understand Tennessee came into the game with the number one scoring defense, and they're going to leave the game with the number one scoring defense, holding the Pats 10 points. We got to start recognizing the best defense in football might still be in the AFC South. It just might not, it just doesn't belong to the Jacksonville Jaguars. Mm. But in the second half, here's the Pats drive chart. Three plays, punt. Eight plays, punt. Five plays, punt. Seven plays in turnover on downs. Three plays, punt. Like, that's, I'm not used to seeing that from the New England Patriots now. The entire second half where you're shut out, you don't even attempt a field goal. You have three punts and one turnover on downs. That's brutal.
At what point do we start pointing to the personnel that maybe Deion Lewis had a point? Maybe they did go cheap and they felt like it's always a next man up mentality. And you know what? You know, you don't have Rob Gronkowski. You don't have any tall receivers. You don't have any one guy that Tom Brady loves to throw to, his go-to guy. He tried to make it Josh Gordon, yep. But he just falling through a couple times. At what point do we really blame it on the personnel?
Well, Jenna, this is the thing. New England, we can't blame it on the personnel because they've always done it, except for the 2007 season, with less than personnel. This is one of the things we always give them credit for. The problem is now they're starting to get injuries that they can't recover from. That offensive line don't look as good as they looked during the regular season. Now, this is what we thought this offensive line would look like. We thought they would have problems built, but we thought Gronk would be there. So they'll be able to run the ball to be able to slow up that offensive line. Edelman, without some help, without Gronk, oh, he's a different guy. And he's a different guy, home and away, because he rides the wave of that crowd and the emotion. So these are the things that I see that are very, very different. And Tom Brady, listen, all that talent around him, lack of talent around him, we normally give him and Belichick credit.
Yeah.
Now you can start to see Tom Brady looking pretty average without the speed on the outside of Cooks and other players.
Edelman was the only guy yesterday prior to the injury he had a real connection with. Edelman had 9 catches for 104. But what the two numbers jump out to me on the stat sheet, aside from Brady's 70 passer rating, which, considering he didn't throw a pick, that's brutal. Usually you have passer rating like that, it's because the interceptions are drawing you down. But one number is 12 targets, but only 4 catches for Josh Gordon.
Josh Gordon, yep.
Trying to get Josh Gordon more and more involved and couldn't connect there. And then 19 carries for 40 yards. When the Pats offense this year has been explosive, it has been well-balanced, tilted towards the running game. Yesterday, mm-hmm. the Titans front, credit to them, shut down Sony Michel, made Cordarrelle Patterson look like a guy playing out of position, and the Pats had no counterpunch. They had no counterpunch. Brady was not particularly sharp. He wasn't with all his weapons, and it showed. That's it. And when I bring up the road stuff, you know why it matters? At 6-3, Pats might be playing a few more road playoff games than we're used to seeing. From
And that's where, if you want the Pats and you want to beat them in the playoffs, you got to get them on the road.
Right.
You got to get them on the road. And we just haven't seen them have to go on the road, especially in that divisional round. Man, if they go in as the third or fourth seed, whoo. They have never done that and gotten to the Super Bowl.
Uncharted waters for the Patriots. All right, got time now for Put a Grade on It, sponsored by CarMax. Tom Brady had a rough one, as we mentioned, throwing for 254 yards, no touchdowns. He's only had one combined in the last three games. CC, wow. Put a grade on Tom Brady's day.
I got to give him a D.
Ooh.
You did not get the chemistry that him and Josh Gordon you thought you would get. Nick mentioned it earlier.
Yeah.
If you're going to target a guy 12 times, man, just out of sync. Josh missed a couple, fell down one. Brady was off a little bit, so I'm going to give Brady a D. I'm sure he would give himself at least a D.
I would also give him a D, and Jenna, you mentioned it. In the last three games, Tom Brady's played what I would consider one great quarter, that fourth quarter against the Packers. Aside from that, he stopped turning the ball over. But maybe in an effort to stop turning the ball over, stop making big plays. The only touchdown they have passing in the last three games is that one to Josh Gordon that won the Packers game. So no touchdowns the previous game, no touchdowns the three quarters against Green Bay, and no passing touchdowns yesterday against Tennessee. It's a D, and more importantly, if he's a student, his last few tests have been trending towards this. That's the concern.
AP football. Coming up, does the Jimmy Butler trade make Philly the best team in the East? Talk some basketball next on First Things First. Tomorrow, Wisconsin faces Xavier at 6:30 Eastern. Then Wednesday, reigning champs Villanova face the Michigan Wolverines in a rematch of last year's national championship game. That's at 6 o'clock. The Gab tip-off game, sponsored by Jeep, only on FS1 and the Fox Sports app. Nick?
Wisconsin's about to hold that L against Xavier. But more importantly, we got Michigan Villanova on FS1 on Wednesday.
I got invited to that game.
Awesome. So go to it.
No, I'm going to go to the 76ers are playing Friday night versus Utah.
Oh, okay.
Philadelphia, I'm coming.
Oh, all right.
They
Philly.
Need a wide receiver or something.
Car service. Let's go see. I'm with you.
Time now for us to go viral. The Saints rolled the Bengals 51-14 yesterday, and with New Orleans offense clicking on all cylinders, it left little to no work for their punter, Thomas Morstead, who was caught after the game schnoozing, taking a nap in his locker. I mean, is there any easier job in America?
A full day's pay for not a full day's work.
He'll take it.
Man, this picture right here behind C was up before the story came up. I thought that was a Gasol brother. I was like, why is one of them in the news? I didn't know that was Thomas Morstead. The good-looking socks, though. Nice little boat shoes.
Couple of supplements.
My man's got a lot going on there. He also, that's the worst locker. I know he's on the
not
road,
a great
but I mean, they put him in the corner
right
next to the Pepsi machine.
It lets you know what we think of the kickers.
Eat it, punter.
All right, stories to start your morning, sponsored by Gillette Clear Gel. Excuse me. Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs continued their winning ways on Sunday against the Cardinals. Mahomes threw for two touchdowns, setting the franchise record, not surprising.
Take that, Lynn Dawson.
31 on the year. Okay, Nick, how important was this game for Kansas City?
Not that important, not that entertaining. You're playing one of the worst teams in the league. It would have been a disaster if they lost, but they were never in jeopardy of losing. What was so impressive to me about Mahomes is I watched this whole game. I didn't think he played very well. And then I look at the stat sheet, I'm like, oh, 10 yards per attempt, threw for 250 and a 125 rating with two touchdowns, no picks. Like, that's the standard, I guess, at the moment he's played to where I watched this game and I think, he was mediocre.
And you got to be careful playing against Arizona's defense because they can get after the passer. Chandler Jones was a problem yesterday. So I think all these games are important. Nick, that's a young team. They haven't had a whole bunch of success. These players haven't been successful. Playing at home,
sure.
You want to keep sending that home field dominated message, and I think they did that yesterday.
All right, moving on to the Packers now. Green Bay got back in the win column, beating the Dolphins 31-12. Aaron Rodgers threw for two touchdowns, while Aaron Jones added two on the ground. Good time to be named Aaron in Green Bay. So you think the Packers can make a playoff push in the NFC?
Man, if they get the ball to Aaron Jones, that was a breath of fresh air to see some speed coming out of the backfield for the Packers. How many times can you just say this Packers organization? Just give them some players. Yeah. The best player in the game. Just supporting with a running game. Great game plan against the Dolphins yesterday.
I want to give one of those players credit. You mentioned in Aaron Jones. The best Aaron on the field yesterday was not Aaron Rodgers. Rodgers yes. was okay. He wasn't bad. He didn't make any big mistakes. But Aaron Jones was the best player for them. And that defense, holding Miami to the field goals early before the game was a blowout, was enormous. And what they did against Miami really throughout the game, holding them just a field goal in the second half, that was great. This, to answer your question, Jenna, at Seattle, at Minnesota, the next couple weeks, that'll determine if they make a playoff push.
All right, to Sunday Night Football now. Cowboys got a big win. Eagles held the L. 27-20 was your final in this one. Zeke had one of his best games of the year with over 180 total yards and two touchdowns. CeCe, how impressed were you with Zeke's night?
I was impressed with Zeke, man. He's a phenomenal athlete. I think the best pure runner. If I had one runner, it'd be this guy. We got some good ones. Todd Gurley, no disrespect to him. But Zeke, he's such power, such speed. Man, him jumping over the safety, running full speed. That's why he was an All-State hurdler in the state of Illinois before he went to Ohio State.
Zeke was the best player on the field by far. And credit to the Cowboys offensive line for neutralizing Fletcher Cox and company up the middle. Like, Fletcher Cox is a name that does not get said enough on television for what a great player he's been throughout his NFL career. Zach Martin, the backup center, those guys did a really good job.
Yeah. After getting knocked out of the game, I thought it was done.
Absolutely.
Came back in there, gut check.
And so that Zeke, though, was spectacular. He's the biggest reason the Cowboys were able to pull off what I consider a huge upset.
All right, finally, Jared Goff and the Rams trying to bounce back after a loss to the New Orleans Saints. Down in the fourth, Goff finds Tyler Higbee for the touchdown. Later in the quarter, Brandon Cooks, watch him take the end around right into the end zone to put the Rams up 12. But the Seahawks would get it to within five. Less than a minute to go, Russell Wilson looking, trying anything, but overthrows, can't convert. Rams win 36-31. CC, how big was this for the
LA Rams?
It was
a big one, especially after last week, suffering the first loss there in New Orleans. How you respond that following week becomes very important. But also, something I want to watch. Dante Fowler, who they traded for from Jacksonville Jaguars late in this football game, he had a penalty, had a couple earlier in the game. You could see on the sideline of all the players, all offseason, we talked about lack of continuity. What about these personalities? This one guy they get from Jacksonville, is he going to be the guy that makes this locker room implode? Just watching him, I just think that it was something in the way he played during the game that it could be something that really dragged the Rams down. They're one of the least penalized teams. We criticize all this offseason. How are these guys going to play together?
Who's
going to control them? They have done a remarkable job. And for them to be one of the top teams in the NFL as far as least penalized, and they're going to get a player who's very, very explosive, who they need his skill on the outside. I just want to see his personality in his second game. I didn't like what I seen in yesterday's competition.
If there's a way to make up for those penalties, though, he did it. When the Seahawks were down a score,
there is late. No way to make up. When you're off the field on third
sure.
down.
Agree. Maybe that's a poor choice of words. The point that I was trying to make is that even if that is mistakes he can't make, he made the biggest play of the game on the field. Seahawks down less than a score, looked like they were moving the football now, and he gets a forced fumble on Russell Wilson inside the 20 that allowed the Rams to go up two scores. Like, so what he was, you maybe saw the bad of Dante Fowler, one of the reasons the Jags might have gotten sick of him, but also the explosive play to change that football game. But I thought there was some cause for concern for the Rams yesterday. Because Seattle ran the ball 34 for 273. 34 carries for 273 yards. Once again, we said before the game, the Rams defense against good quarterbacks has been very susceptible. We saw it again with the Seahawks scoring 31, with Russell having a 123 rating, three touchdowns, no picks. Like, the Rams defense has the names to be in a class above the other great offenses in football, the Saints and the Chiefs, but they're not playing at a much higher level than the defenses of the Saints and the Chiefs. So that the Fowler made a big play, but the Rams defense was getting gashed throughout this football game. But once again, like, I didn't think Jared Goff was particularly sharp, and yet guys were running wide open, so it didn't matter that much. The Rams are going to be able to match you point for point throughout the year. This was an incredibly important win, though, because of what happened last week and who they have Monday.
Right.
A week from today, they're in Mexico City against the Kansas City
and
Chiefs.
And watch out, because Cooper Kupp, I believe, suffered a significant injury there late in the game. They miss him. If they had lost this game and then another significant injury, you know, those losses, they pile up quick. So I thought it was significant, especially against a division rival, to be able to get that win.
Wait, really funny story. At one moment in the game, they took a camera shot of Ndamukong Suh and Aaron Donald talking to each other. I mean, they took up the entire screen. And my three-year-old turns to Stephanie and says, "Those are big guys, Mommy. Those are big guys. They were tremendous."
Oh,
I mean,
man.
They may not have played the best game, but they have a
Donald once again had a great game. And Sue, like, it's amazing when you see them on the screen together, because Sue is almost a half a head taller than Donald, and Donald is just out there wrecking
people. Yeah. All right, let's turn to the NBA
big
now. Big news this weekend.
I
Timberwolves.
That was good information. Don't know how funny it was.
Timberwolves, who appeared not to want to trade Jimmy Butler, traded Jimmy Butler. After shooting down a deal from Houston, the T-Wolves sent Butler to Philadelphia for Robert Covington and Dario Saric. So Butler now forms his own three-headed monster in the East, joining forces with Joel Embiid and Ben Simmons. All right, here we go, Nick. Does Jimmy Butler make the Sixers the best team in the East now?
So I picked the Sixers to make the finals before the year. And I don't believe in changing predictions, but if I did believe in changing predictions, given how they played the first dozen games, I would have. Because they did not look like they didn't look like one of the three best teams in the East through the first dozen games of the year. But Jimmy Butler changed some things now. Now, if they play the Raptors in a series, they have three of the four best players. If they play the Bucks in a series, they have three of the four best players. If they play the Celtics in a series, they might have the three best players and certainly three of the four best players. Now, a team that was lacking depth just got even more shallow. But this is...
But what does that starting five look like now?
Well, I mean, it looks like you've got three legit all-stars, one superstar in Embiid, one legit top 15 guy in Butler, and a guy in Ben Simmons who hasn't developed this year the way I would have hoped, but was playing at an all-star caliber his rookie year, even if he just stays at that level. This is an enormous addition without sacrificing much of any of their future, see?
Yeah, I'm concerned about Philadelphia for a couple reasons. In the trade, they gave up two shooters. Now, this is a team that don't have a bunch of shooters. Now, if Ben Simmons had come back this offseason, which I said he wasn't, with a jump shot, because people laugh and joke, but when you can't shoot the basketball, it hinders how good you can be. And, yeah, on paper, you can say, yeah, they play Toronto in the series, they got three of the four best players. They're going to need it because their bench stinks.
Yes.
And how is Jimmy Butler going to play? Is he going to be a perimeter player? Is he going to be a spot-up three-point shooter? Because he's got to be with this team because there's not enough room to drive. Their point guard can't shoot. He's got to drive. Ben Simmons, he can't shoot. He's got to drive. So Joel Embiid, I know he can shoot the three, but he's a post-up presence that they said this year, we want to go back to old-school basketball, put him in the post. It's hard to do that when you don't have the shooter. So I just want to see the style for which they're going to develop. Because to me, when you get in a seven-game series against Boston, against Toronto, they're going to have a spacing problem. Joel Embiid has been spectacular this season.
Spectacular.
But the other guys are not developing. Fultz, their point guard, is not developing. Ben Simmons, you could say he's playing at an all-star level. He's not developing an outside shot. So those things become a problem.
Listen, all of the points about the guys other than Embiid, well, I agree with the Embiid point as well, but all of them are well taken. But I don't want to overanalyze this. Embiid is playing like the league MVP. Embiid and Steph Curry are playing better than any two players in the league, and Steph's injured right now. So right now Embiid's playing like the league MVP. He put up another 40 and near 20 game over the weekend. He has been so good. That team just added one of the best two-way players in the entire league and gave up two guys that Covington for the last year and a half and Sarge just for this year, I thought were underperforming. So Philly just got, I think, considerably better. The Simmons stuff is a concern, and for me it's really disappointing. You know, I said last year Ben Simmons has best player in the league potential. He didn't get better between year one and year two.
As a public, you should never assume that guys are going to get a jump shot. Like, we didn't know Michael Jordan was going to be who he was because we didn't know if he was going to be able to shoot.
Right.
We did not predict LeBron would be able to do 27, 8, and 8. Why? Because we didn't know. Man, how good is he ultimately going to be able to shoot? In this modern basketball, this NBA, with that three-point line,
yeah,
you have to be able to be able to maximize your total skill, to be able to maximize his size, you got to be able to shoot at least from 15 feet.
Sure.
Giannis did it. Giannis moved that back out to the three-point line. That's why we have him in the conversation of one day going to be the greatest basketball player. Shooting the ball from the perimeter, it's a necessary evil to be able to have in the NBA.
Nick, why would the Timberwolves pass on Houston's offer of 4 first-round picks for Philadelphia's offer?
All right, so I think some people saw this trade and they said, oh, that Houston stuff must have been misreported. It was not. I can tell you absolutely unequivocally, Houston made multiple offers, all of which involved at least 3, and some of which involved 4 first-round picks. But this is the problem when the guy who's pulling the trigger on the trade is also the head coach. Tom Thibodeau wanted the following things: players, not picks, veteran players, not young players, and to send him out east instead of west so he wasn't buttressing a potential team they're fighting with for the playoffs. When you have that narrow of a window that you're looking for, you're not going to get your best offer. You're not going to do the best, because Tom Thibodeau knows what's good are picks and young players if I get fired. He made, I think, the best trade for Tom Thibodeau, but not the best trade for the Timberwolves, which that franchise does. Their fans have been through a lot, and I think deserve better than someone who's worried about his own interests.
Wait, quickly, give us a little expansion. Why not a great move for the Timberwolves?
Because I don't think they got the best package possible. Like, Sarge is fine. Covington was a good story who has regressed over the last year. And you got no picks, 0 picks out of this. Like, no one that can be a blue chipper out of this.
If you want some inside information on what kind of deal you thought the Timberwolves were going to make, read Kevin Garnett's commentary when that they were saying they were going to trade for Jimmy Butler. And Kevin Garnett, what he said about Glenn Taylor, the owner. He said he was going to screw it up. He's going to mess this up. And they said, Kevin, why is he going to mess this up? He said, because he don't know anything about basketball. They messed this one up. You should never give up those players for Jimmy Butler. Tremendous asset. And as Nick confirmed, it's real. What Houston offered those 4 first-round picks, like, that was real.
But now you look at Minnesota with Jimmy Butler. They got the wrong end of the trade on the front end, getting rid of Zach LaVine, who's top 5 in the NBA right now in scoring, and Lauri Markkanen. And then on the back end, only getting this back. That's on both sides. They messed up the Jimmy Butler transaction.
Their loss, the Sixers gained today. All right, coming up, back to football. Has Baker Mayfield proven he was worth the number one pick? That's next. First things first. Back here, first things first, Super Bowl champ Chris Caney is with us.
In the building.
What's up, Chris? Good
Nothing
to have
much,
you.
Nothing much, Jenna. I'm doing pretty good.
Great weekend of football.
Great weekend of football. Also a great weekend for me. Celebrated another birthday.
Get out of here.
So
happy birthday. Very
Not
nice.
Not sure if I'm a year wiser. We'll see how that goes.
I bet you will be. I bet after the highlights you will be.
Did we send you something?
Y'all did send me something. I appreciate
the birthday present. Candy.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate
it. I didn't know that.
On behalf of Jenna's favorite cupcakes or something like that, right?
Yeah, baked by Melissa.
There you go. That's how we do it.
Curl. Kale swirled in. Baker Mayfield and the Browns trying to take down the Falcons yesterday. Not an easy task. First quarter, let's go Baker. Finds Rashard Higgins for the 28-yard touchdown. Made it look easy. Later in the half, Baker again, this time to Duke Johnson for a 13-yard score. Baker would end the day with 3 touchdowns. Nick Chubb would seal the victory with a 92-yard run. This, the longest play from scrimmage in Browns history. Cleveland goes on to win 28-16. The Atlanta Falcons fall to 4-5, but let's start with the Browns. Here's Baker Mayfield after the win.
And when I woke up this morning, I was feeling pretty dangerous.
I care to expand on that.
I just woke up feeling real dangerous.
I got to tell you, he's actually a really funny guy. If you follow his Instagram account, he's got some really funny stuff there. All right, Chris, what did the Browns prove last night with that win?
Well, I don't know what the Browns proved. I think this is a young football team that's trying to find a way to win games. And after losing the last month, you figured eventually the Browns will find themselves on the right side of it just because they have a lot of talent. Remember, a lot of losing went into being able to construct a really talented roster. They just got to figure out how to win. And so I think that's where the Cleveland Browns are. But I think this is more of an indictment on the Atlanta Falcons, because just when you think they're about to turn the corner, The Falcons always Falcon. And what I mean by that is they let you down, right? You thought, okay, they won three straight games. They came out of the bye week and dominated the Redskins in D.C. You thought, okay, maybe the Falcons are going to start to get on a run.
Yeah.
We know they dealt with a lot of injuries earlier on in the season. Now they're trying to figure out how to offset those injuries, guys filling in, playing different roles on this team. Maybe they could make a push for that second wild card spot in the NFC.
And they fell on their face.
But no, not the Falcons. They didn't do it. They didn't get it done yesterday, and I thought they missed a tremendous opportunity.
See, with Baker Mayfield, I'm going to treat his career like our staff treats anytime you invite people over for football. This is a party I don't mind being early for. I don't mind show. You and Mangini say all the time you don't want to be, or you'd rather be late than early to the party. Nah, man, this guy's a star. He's going to be a star. We have seen the light turn on the last month for him. We saw flashes the first three games he played, that three and a half games he played. We saw throws, but the numbers weren't there. Last month of football, 9 touchdowns, 2 picks, a 105 rating. That first half yesterday, 12 for 12, perfect quarterback rating. I know the Falcons' defense is undermanned. I understand they're dealing with a lot of injuries. But this was a game where they were touchdown underdogs, and the Browns dominated throughout. The running game helped.
That's huge.
Baker didn't make a single mistake.
Yeah.
I didn't see Baker miss one throw significantly, and he's not doing it with the greatest group of wide receivers. Jarvis Landry's been one of the more disappointing free agent signings up to this point.
Didn't I tell you, though?
What?
He did say that.
But see, I wouldn't, but that's one I didn't disagree with you on. I kept saying I thought he was a volume guy in Miami, just a bunch of 100 dinks and dunks a year, that his catch numbers were great. But so you and I were on the same page there. I thought, now, the receiving corps as a whole, when they had Gordon.
I was at the top of the page. He was at the bottom.
Oh, okay.
He tried to put him on, but he wasn't listening to it.
But regardless, the point is, like, what they're doing without a real number one receiver, what Baker is growing into, we said 2 weeks ago, what was, Jenna, you asked us, what does Baker have to do the last half of the season? And C and I said simultaneously, survive.
Survive, that's it.
Maybe we should have said thrive, because that's what he's done. Like, a ton of credit, man. It is a great team win. The defense played great. The running back played great. But the story's about Baker, because the Browns, for the first time in my life, have a real franchise quarterback.
But don't you get the feeling that the answer would have been survive if it was the old regime of 2 weeks ago?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, just maybe, Greg Williams, I mean, you saw some more creative things. You saw a couple plays that we didn't normally see. You saw him open up the offense a little bit more. Has that changed at all? Did the game plan change at all to help Baker Mayfield out?
I would say that they've put a heavy emphasis on running the football. Kitchens is the appointed offensive coordinator. He's done a good job as far as trying to protect the quarterback. I'm not going to back him up 40 times and have him get matted to the canvas, because he won't survive the rest of the season. So the emphasis on mixing some run with the pass. The thing that I think is one of the most impressive things, I think he spread the ball around to 8 different receivers.
Mm-hmm.
But Canty, their yardage they had, the top receivers, 31, 33, 39, 33, 22, 28, 18, 6, 6. Like, he was spreading the ball around to everyone. And you typically are not going to see those bad numbers with a quarterback playing almost a perfect game. So, as Nick pointed out, he's not throwing the ball to a bunch of household names, to a bunch of Pro Bowlers. So, what Baker has done at this point in the season, still having this confidence, after they fired the offensive coordinator, they fired the head coach. They asked him, how'd you feel this morning? I felt like things was getting ready to get pretty good. That right there is a star in the making. It's kind of like Johnny Manziel, but he can actually play.
Yeah, he can actually ball a little bit. But here's the thing about that. When you take the pressure off of Baker Mayfield from a down-in, down-out basis, and he can turn around and hand the ball off to Nick Chubb, that makes a huge difference. I mean, you had double-digit rush attempts by Nick Chubb in the first half. And, of course, I think he was right around 50 yards. But then he explodes in the second half, ends up racking up 176 yards, including that 92-yard touchdown run. And you're saying, okay, so his average made it look maybe a little inflated because of that one run.
Mm-hmm.
But if you take away that run, he still was giving you 4.5 yards a pop. So, I mean, that's the big difference. When you can take the pressure off the quarterback and off the offense by turning around and handing it off, it makes everybody better and keeps Baker Mayfield from being in situations where he can make mistakes.
And you have to give Greg Williams how that defense played against this Falcons offense. Because the Falcons offense, we can say the injuries are on the defensive side. Ain't nothing been wrong with their offense.
Mm-hmm.
They've been hurting people offensively. But the game plan they put together to be able to slow down those Falcons, I thought was very impressive.
And I want to give John Dorsey enormous credit. It's one thing to come into a situation where the previous regime stockpiled you with draft picks. Mm. It's another thing to then go make the picks. He got the right guy at number one. He took, to me, a shocking pick at number four, Denzel Ward, mm-hmm. who continues to be a star. Mm-hmm. Like, he is playing like a future shutdown corner. They took a center at 33. I don't think he's played enough yet to fairly evaluate him. But at 35, Nick Chubb. So the three guys who are playing a lot from this draft, his first draft, A-plus pick, and now that Nick Chubb's actually being used, he looks like a legitimate starting running back in this league. Like, John Dorsey could have – there's another where here it goes Darnold and then Bradley Chubb instead mm-hmm. of, you know, at number four, mm-hmm. and it's a totally different story in Cleveland. He took what I consider – the gutsy picks as well. Mm-hmm. Baker wasn't the safe pick.
No.
Denzel Ward wasn't the safe pick.
Right.
He went with what he believed and what he had scouted. And you see the talent there to go along with Myles Garrett, Larry Ogunjobi from the previous regime.
Normally you change the players to make the team better. The coaches in this situation needed to be changed. The players were just right, and it's fitting this team quite well. Kenny, stick around. Coming up, did the New Orleans Saints prove they are the best team in the NFL yesterday? That's next on First Things First.
Ever wonder how to get the hottest new sneakers, the ones that barely hit shelves? The answer, StockX, a revolutionary new marketplace for buying and selling 100% authentic sneakers, streetwear, watches, and handbags. Millions are already using StockX to find everything after it sells out, from the latest Yeezys to every retro Jordan to the hottest new streetwear from brands like Supreme and Bape. It even allows users to buy and sell pre-owned, excellent condition luxury handbags and watches from brands like Louis Vuitton, Chanel, Gucci, Rolex, Omega, Tudor, and more. It uses the same principles as the stock market to make buying and selling as safe and easy as possible. You get real-time market data for intelligent buying and selling. It gives you access to tons of historical price data as well. See exactly how much an item has sold for in the past and how much it's selling for now, because it's crucial in knowing the value of the items you're buying. So go to StockX.com/FTF. That's StockX.com/FTF. StockX. Now you know.
Awesome. Bad news for the L.A. Rams. Sean McVay will be doing some roster maneuvering this week. That's because receiver Cooper Kupp is out for the year with a torn ACL. Kupp was having a great year, caught 40 passes for over 560 yards, 6 touchdowns on the air. All right, redeem yourself. See, how big of a deal is this for L.A. to now be out without Cooper Kupp?
Oh, it's a big deal, but this is why Sean McVay. Hey, young fella. Hey, 32-year-old genius. Let's come up with some stuff. Let's put some other people. Let me see what you got. Let me see the other personnel. Let me see what formations you're going to use. The biggest problem is they are predominantly a 31 team, 3 receivers and 1 running back. Now let's see. What do they do moving forward? This is up to Sean McVay. The reason why they call him those things, I think he'll earn that reputation in it. They'll come up with some creative stuff.
And when Cooper Kupp missed week 8, his replacement, Josh Reynolds, I think had 2 touchdown catches. This is going to be real bad for somebody, either the Rams or Cooper Kupp, because Cooper Kupp, it has been a great story his first year and a half in the NFL. If they all of a sudden, whomever they put in there, if slot receiver for the Rams is a spot that always is open, that Sean McVay schemes you open.
It's like Wes Welker, then Edelman. Is it just the position
Correct.
Or is it the play caller and everything?
And so, like, I like Cooper Kupp as a player. I liked him as a college player. And so I think this is a loss for them. If it's not a loss for them, it's a huge loss for Cooper Kupp and what people in NFL circles think of.
One thing I know, Cooper Kupp's overall speed is underrated. Sometimes we get in these stereotypes. Mm-hmm. Oh, he's white.
Oh, he's
undersized. He's in the slot. He don't really have downfield speed. Oh, no. Adam Thielen can burn, and Kupp can run it. He can get it.
That's it for Cooper Kupp. Finally, moving on to the Chargers. They are 7-2 behind some great play out of Phillip Rivers this season. The Chargers are quietly making a Super Bowl run. Rivers thrown for 21 touchdowns, 4 picks with a career-high 115 passer rating. Rivers says he's playing the most consistent football of his career. See, how impressive has Phillip Rivers been this year? Because we're not talking about him very much.
That's been the story of his career, Jenna. Since he's come into the league, he's always been overshadowed either by playing with the Chargers or by the quarterbacks that he came into the league with,
Eli,
who have gone on to win Super Bowls and everything. But since he's been in the league, he's been one of the best throwers of the football. Unusual throwing motion, very, very ugly. You can't even teach what he does. But It's like a jump shot. It can be ugly. It's like a golf swing. It can be ugly.
If it works.
But can it be effective? And he's one of the most effective passers, getting the ball out of his hands. And people just don't know the type of talent that they do have there. Man, they got good wide receivers. They brought Antonio Gates back after getting an injury to their tight end. And Melvin Gordon, man, he's one of the special running backs in this league that we don't talk about. Coming out of the backfield, catching the ball and running the ball between the tackles. And that the thing that I think was very, very surprising is Melvin Gordon's all breakaway speed. So, yes, Phillip Rivers is taking advantage of that. I've always had a great deal of respect for his game and thought he was worthy of more credit than he ever got.
Last night on Monday Night Football, they did the Is Eli Manning a Hall of Famer debate. And here's what I know. If Eli gets in, this guy got to get in. The numbers are not even close. Like, Phillip Rivers, throughout his career, has been one of the most consistent quarterbacks in football. And this year is breaking all of his own standards. Like, show Phillip Rivers' average year, which is a Pro Bowl caliber year, compared to what he's doing this year. Completion percentage up 3 points. Yards per pass up more than a full yard. His average year, 28 touchdowns to 14 picks. This year on pace for 37-7. And the passer rating jumped 20 points from his career average. 20 points. Even in the inflated 2018 NFL passing stats, Phillip Rivers is having the type of year that if Pat Mahomes wasn't in his own division, Phillip Rivers would be the guy being discussed out of the AFC as an MVP candidate. He's been awesome. And the Chargers now, they got two losses early to the Rams and the Chiefs. They probably at some point have Joey Bosa coming back. This is a dangerous, really good football team that if, for the first time in a half decade, they get their kicking situation settled, nobody's going to want to face them. And I'll add one other thing. They're the only team other than the Chiefs in the AFC that controls their path to the one seed. If the Chargers win out, they're the one seed. Like, they would win the tiebreaker with Kansas City if they went out. So, Chargers are a dangerous team. Phillip Rivers, the biggest reason.
And Phillip Rivers, he's been on some special offenses. I mean, he's played with some good offensive talent. Typically, we don't talk about it as much, but this year, because they have so much balance, Melvin Gordon coming there, he's facing the least amount of pressure that he's faced in any year in his career. So those numbers, those 20 points are playing out because they're putting less pressure on him because they fear what he can do to the defense.
All right, let's move on to the Eagles. The team that cruised to a Super Bowl win last season has followed that up with a bit of a head scratcher this season. 4-5 on the year, coming off a disappointing loss to the Cowboys. They now head to New Orleans to try and salvage a playoff run against arguably the best team in the league. We'll call that one a challenge. Doug Peterson addressed all of that to his team yesterday.
They're disappointed. They're disappointed in the way they play. They're disappointed in the outcome of the game. And they know that, you know, we talk about having no regrets. You know, no regrets during the week and no regrets on Sundays. And right now we got to continue to work on that.
It's the first time, though, that you guys have said that messaging of having to look in the mirror, that you've had those moments where you haven't been able to fight through. So do you have to change your messaging at this point to come out the other side?
Well, I think that's something I'd have to consider, quite frankly, because I don't know any other way to do it but to look internally. Am I giving enough as a head football coach? Am I giving enough to the team? Am I giving up, you know, am I sacrificing enough in my game planning, in my study during the week? You know, I got to look at myself, and that's what I ask the players to do is they got to look and see, are they getting extra conditioning? Are they getting extra film study during the week? Are they getting rest at night? That all those things are part of wins and losses, and so that's something that'll never change.
Doug Peterson questioning how much he's giving to his team. Not sure that's something the team wants to hear. CeCe, how much of the Eagles' struggles can be pinned on Doug Peterson?
Doug needs to stop talking. They need to stop all the press conferences because Doug don't know what the heck he's talking about. All right?
Just grasping,
why don't we do this? After a second year as a head coach, right, in Philadelphia, they won the Super Bowl, right? You know what I'm going to do first, Jenna? I'm getting ready to write a book. I ain't never been no head coach. But why are you writing a book? Well, what do you know? In your 2 years, the jury was out on you. Now, this was a magic playoff run that they went on. And now in doing that, so you write a book. That's how you're going to start. You know something, guys? I got this thing figured out. Life, football, I got it figured out. I'm getting ready to write a book. All right, you started off wrong. Oh, we have more fun than they have in New England. I would have stopped that messaging point because you don't know what they do in New England. You've never been in New England. And it wasn't the right type of focus to have in the offseason. So, yes, Doug Peterson, he's grasping at straws.
Yeah.
There is no way that I weekly try to face a press conference and try to explain to people. Stop talking. Stop trying to tell people what you think they might want to hear. Stop answering Bill Belichick. The reason why his press conferences are that way, because it's not his responsibility to reveal everything to the media, because it's not going to help the team get better. So the more he stays up there, the more he answers questions, the more he's like, well, you know something? I don't know. Yeah, I guess so. I have never thought about that. Maybe I should start looking at myself. Well, you're not ready for the press conference. Doug Peterson, regardless of what we say, he's won a Super Bowl, but he is still learning how to be a head coach. And every week I hear a soundbite that lets me know that this is not a team, that they're not going on leadership. He don't have the heartbeat of this team right now. This is an average football team that's very, very talented. They are not playing up to their talent level. And the reason why, their head coach should take responsibility for that, because we got teams out there not as talented, playing a lot better than the Eagles are playing. So Doug should look at himself. He shouldn't go into a press conference and not have an answer to those questions, or he should just remove all those things and stop trying to explain, especially to the local media, what they're not supposed to understand it.
To me, good leadership, if I have to distill it down into one sentence, I would define good leadership as consistency of message and a clear objective. That now, everything else is a bonus. Do you inspire me? Am I a little afraid of you, maybe, instead of inspired? Like, you can put something on it. You can approach it from a different direction. But what I would want, what I felt professionally the first time I got any time in my career was once I got to this network, was I knew exactly what the objective was, and I got a consistent message every day how to achieve that objective. How many different messages have we just heard from Doug Peterson? And he's only talking to us through the media, 15 to 20 minutes three times a week. How often are you talking to them players? Maybe more importantly, how often is he talking to his other coaches? What message is he giving them? You can't achieve an objective if you don't know what it is and what your leader believes the path is. The reason the NFL very often gets compared, I think sometimes unfortunately, to the military, but one similarity they have is a clear chain of command, where what he says is what goes without a whole lot of questioning of it, and we're all going to go in that direction. I don't know that the Eagles have that part figured out. What I do know is they were coming off a bye, which is the one time during the season you can have the most impact as a head coach. Your bye week, Andy Reid off a bye, historically great. Belichick off a bye, historically. Like, the best coaches are great off a bye. And they got embarrassed. I know it looks to me like they missed some of his lieutenants, Frank Reich, John DeFilippo. They look like they missed some of the other brains in that room up to this point in the season. I know that.
What if you're the players? Take me through this from the players' perspective. And you hear your head coach come in. You're probably savvy enough to know whether he knows and he's on point or whether he's just trying to figure out himself along with you. Is it hard to get up and play? Is it hard to rally around that? Is it hard when the message is not on point to get out there every Sunday?
You know, Jenna, it's not about the coach. There ain't no guy in the NFL that's motivated by his coach to play football. Every guy in the NFL, all 1,600 of those guys, they're living out their dream. So regardless if the coach helps them or not, they got a job to do. They have an assignment to do. So regardless if they get good direction, if they get good coaching, they have a family and they have a career that they have to take care of. So thinking guys won't be motivated to play because the coach is off point, no. Because each one of those guys, you know what's going to happen in Philadelphia with that veteran lineup? They're going to get rid of most of those guys.
But then what?
So guys are looking out for themselves. Like, yes, I don't think that the Eagles in last year, there was no inspiration from Doug Peterson. He didn't come up with the underdog thing. Like, they just built on the momentum. They won 13 games during the regular season, all right? They had a bye. They had a good matchup in the divisional round. They had Case Keenum in the championship game. That crowd was unbelievable. Now, in that game, they played a great football game. And in the Super Bowl, one of the best football games I've ever seen. But since then, what did Doug Peterson learn from that? And all we can say is he's missing an offensive coordinator. He's missing a quarterback coach, because after 2 weeks of preparation, I was not pleased with the offensive game plan against Dallas and how they were going to use Golden Tate. All right? I would have come up with something more creative to get Golden Tate involved in the game plan with 2 weeks to prepare.
All right, see, I get what you're saying about the 1,600 guys are self-motivated, but I've also heard you talk. I know how self-motivated you were, but I also know what you talk, how you talk about Denny Green. So let me ask it this way. Aside from schematic advantage on Sunday, the great coaches, what do they do for the players? What do even the self-motivated guys, what edge do the great coaches do? What made Denny better than some of the other coaches you had had?
Some of the great coaches, they can look at aspects of your game that is not a strong suit and tell you things about yourself to try to grow your game. So it's, man, I didn't see myself. And most of these guys think they're very, very talented and have a lot of confidence. But when a coach can take you out of your narrow-mindedness and say, you know something? I believe there's a bigger role for you. James White in New England. You're never going to be a featured back, son. But one day, there's going to be some games where I'm going to throw you 10 passes. There's going to be some games you're going to score 3 touchdowns. There's going to be some games where you're going to be a hero in the Super Bowl. But you're never going to be a featured guy. And James has run with that role because Belichick has carved it out and helped him grow from that. But if you don't tell players what they're going to do and then follow up on it, like their offensive line, they can't be physical. Guys are not, they're having guys not having great years, so it's hard for the coach to be able to lie to guys. Denny Green was a great coach. I have not seen that in Doug Peterson. Yes, he's won a Super Bowl, but man, he just happened to be on the right team at the right time, and they came up with the plays. Now, he did call the Philly special. I give him a lot of credit from that. But has he grown from that? There's just a lot of questions in his day-to-day decision-making from my perspective.
Peterson's, in my eyes, got to bridge the gap between a gutsy coach that understands the numbers, which I think he is, to the gap from there to a consistently advantageous head coach.
Right.
You know, I think there are the Philly special, what they do on fourth downs. I think Philly is a smart, gutsy team, but that doesn't make that's not all that coaching is. The other part of it is the stuff it seems to me he's learning on the fly.
All right, let's take a break. Coming up, talk some basketball. Have we seen the last of Carmelo Anthony in the NBA? That's next on First Things First. Here, first things first, we're talking Carmelo Anthony, or as some in NBA circles call it, melodrama. Looks like Carmelo Anthony's short time with the Rockets has already come to a close. That despite CeCe's emphatic rooting for the gentleman this season. We tried, see.
Lasted
according to reports.
4 days.
Yeah, but he was in it.
As soon as I root for a guy, he quits.
Hey, that's usually my block, my corner. Also how you say it. According to reports, Melo's representatives are looking at potential destinations for the 16-year former star. Melo's averaging a career low 13.4 points this season. All right, Nick, is Melo being unfairly blamed for the Rockets' slow start?
Listen, as a wise man once said, everybody needs a fall guy at times, and Melo is the fall guy right now for the Rockets, but he's been a big part of the problem. He's not the only problem. Melo could leave today, and the Rockets still have got major issues. They are still not the defense they were last year and not even close to the offense they were last year. But Melo's been really bad. There's no denying it. This is now the second straight year Melo was supposed to be the third star on a team that had an unquestioned top two, and he couldn't fill that role. And listen, I'm a Syracuse graduate. I have always been a Carmelo Anthony supporter, and I think he has become a historically underrated player. With all that said, I don't know what Melo's role is in the NBA at this point. It's not just about not accepting a role. It's about a drastically deteriorated skill set and a game that has not aged well. And by the way, a lot of guys don't age into their 16th season well. LeBron's kind of changed the way we look at it. But, yeah, this is it got real bad real quick for Melo in the last 3 years, and this is where we're at right now. So I don't think he's to blame for everything with Houston, but he's certainly not part of the solution.
I'm not going to put Melo as far as blaming what's going on in Houston, but what's happened in his career, he can only look to himself to blame. Because if you look during his career, he never looked at changing. He never looked at changing his game. And more importantly, the thing that's hurting him now is he never looked at changing his body. And if you are going to be a professional athlete and you're going to try to maximize what you have, yeah, he scored the basketball at a great level. He might be whatever list Nick has him on. I don't care. But did he maximize his talent? Hell no. He should have been better. He could have been in better shape. He could have been a defensive player. He chose not to. So, yes, he did have a great career. This is not even about, oh, Houston, is he to blame for Houston? Melo's to blame for his deterioration. Because Dwayne Wade, when he's fading out, we don't say nothing about Dwayne Wade. You know the reason why?
Why? Yeah.
Because he did everything. He hired Michael Jordan's old attorney. His knees and everything, they betrayed him. So he went out at least giving himself the best chance to have a great career. I know it's not just the championships. It's what do you do? Chris Paul. I can't fault Chris Paul if he never wins a championship. You know the reason why? Man, he's one of the toughest guys. Every year, he was prepared to try to put his team in the position. Did he have some unfortunate breaks at the unfortunate times? Yes. But did he put himself in the best position that he could be the most successful? Yes. Melo? No. You got to take better care of your body if you want to be able to maximize. But it also lets you know what type of talent that he did have.
I agree with nearly all of that. But what I do think is
tell me where I'm wrong then.
What? I said I agree with nearly all of that. I think it's a little the only part, if you're saying tell you where you're wrong, the only part that I think you're glossing over too much is, yes, he was a great scorer. Melo was a professional scorer, which is what we've had in this league for as long as the NBA has existed. For as long as the NBA has existed, teams have been totally fine with having a guy on their team. What's your job? Get us 25 a night, not much else. Like, there's no shame in that. Guys have made the Hall of Fame on that. Like, that has been a great career path for some great players. That's that. So I don't want to gloss over that part of it. But the other thing is, and I'm glad you mentioned Dwayne Wade, guys deteriorating starting in year 10, which is when it really happened with Melo. Melo's peak was right about year 10. That was the year that LeBron was one vote away from the unanimous MVP, and that one vote was for Carmelo Anthony. Since then, he's gotten worse each year to where now he's nearly unplayable. Dwayne Wade, same draft class. Dwayne Wade actually peaked, I think, in year 6, held that peak for about 3 years, and right around year 10 started slowly deteriorating. His body gave up on him. Dwight Howard, the draft class after Carmelo Anthony, he peaked around year 9 and then slowly has deteriorated.
I would say he peaked in high school, but...
Okay, fair enough. His NBA peak was around from year 6 to 9 of his career and then it's gotten worse each and every year. It is... What LeBron's doing, we have to throw it out. It's an outlier. You're not supposed to be an excellent player in year 16. Melo thought he could still be last year in year 15 a star. I remember guys...
Last year, he had issues with... He didn't want to come off the bench.
Correct. That has been... Melo, I think, as of last year, one of his big problems was... Not his physical skill and basketball skill, but his mentality of where he was.
Jenna, one thing we have control over, we all control our attitude.
Yeah.
And to me, it's disappointing if Melo, as good a player he's been, as great a career he's had, that he can't even be a role player at the end of his career. To me, that's disgusting. Why can't he? He's in team sports. Why can't he sacrifice? I can play a little defense. I can rebound. If he loves playing basketball that much, and if him and Chris Paul are that good of friends... You wouldn't want to hang out with one of your friends the last year of your career? Like, you can't make any type of contribution? To me, that's disappointing as an athlete.
Well, all right, so that's interesting. So I want to – let's stay on that for just a second. See, you think at this point Melo has the ability to do things he's not doing? I don't think he has the ability.
No. I think it's a bad character flaw for him not to be able to do some of these things.
But it was – if he got lobotomized, if he was hypnotized, if it was – I'm saying you think his body would allow him right now to be a good defender, to be a good role player. Because I just think his skills have deteriorated.
Nick, when you're young and you decide I ain't going to play no defense, you think you're going to play some defense when you get old?
No, that's correct.
So his overall mentality and not even approaching basketball the right way. He has never even tried to be an elite rebounder, trying to be a marginal defender. He has never tried. 2 years ago, we was watching all these videos of Hoodie Melo. He was going around losing weight. He wasn't trying to be a complete player. All he's trying to do is get his shots up. That has been his consistent theme. How do I get my shots up? So he didn't evolve as a person. He was not aware of himself and was not aware of his career.
So what happens to Melo now?
Man, the Lakers are
released?
The Lakers. I know people will say, "Oh, LeBron and the Lakers." LeBron had two chances with the Cavs to try to go tell the GM to go make a play for Melo. Never did. I would be shocked if the Lakers look at him. I know there was a report Philly would look at him. Listen, I say this as a Melo fan. Good teams should not add him. I was dead wrong about Melo and the Rockets this year. Dead wrong. I thought he could be a good bench piece. I thought he would be a good seventh guy in their rotation. No.
And so what if you're any team that has real championship or playoff aspirations, he is not going to be of benefit to you on the court. He's just not a, right now, an above-average NBA player. That's where he is.
You're not the only one. Houston made tremendous mistakes because they thought getting rid of Trevor Ariza and Luke Machar-Baramute that, oh, this is going to be okay. Oh, those guys can be replaced. Ha, yeah. How's it looking now? How your defense looking now? How's your spot-up shooters looking now? They really missed those two players. And there were people on this network who said they were going to dearly miss them, and that team wouldn't even be able to approach the type of team that they had last season.
And that, to full circle, that those moves are a bigger part of Houston's issues than Melo's struggles. Melo. That's why he can't be fully to blame or even the majority of the blame. But if I'm – I mean, Washington Wizards should bring him in so he can be with Dwight and John Wall and just
enough.
Be a nice little...
No more with Melo. We're done.
Oh, we're done? You're ending his career?
Listen, I've been very
Carmelo.
Quiet.
He quit.
He quit. He quit on us. We quit on him. It's terrible to say, but I'm done talking.
Have we ever had a player bought out from a buyout?
How much more
first
round for this? Back here, first things first. So Fox Sports has teamed up with For the Win for the College Football Fan Index. Each week, you, the fans, will be ranking college football experiences. And this week, we're ranking best quarterbacks. Oregon came in first, followed by Alabama, Washington State, and Clemson. Nick, what are your thoughts?
My only thought is, how does Kyler Murray not make the list? I got no problem with Oregon's kid. He's probably going to be the number one pick of the draft if he comes out. Tua's going to win the Heisman. Trevor Lawrence has been great for Clemson. Will Greer at West Virginia. I get all that. But I feel like switch out Washington State, put on Oklahoma and Kyler Murray. That would be my one tweak, see?
Yeah. I mean, you got to have Kyler Murray in there. He's sensational. He got better numbers than Baker Mayfield, who won the Heisman Trophy last year. So it's a list. A good list. It should have been a list of a few more quarterbacks.
A few extra names. And I feel like Herbert, that's about his pro potential more than what he's done at Oregon this year.
All right, we'll get to L. Bell in a second. But first, Chris Paul embarrasses Nikola Jokic with some fancy dribbling right here.
Oh, he does a few of these a month. He just toys with them. He's got one of the best handles.
Man. Jokic can do a lot of things on offense, and that's what he can do on defense. Get made to look like one of
Watch this. College basketball, Georgetown, Illinois. Mack McClung drives baseline with a nice up-and-under move for the reverse layup.
Below the rim.
Mack stays on the highlights now.
Yeah.
Now, listen, it's one of our favorites from high school. We followed him. Now he's a freshman at Georgetown. And, yes, he's white. I'm going to say that. Yes, he's white and making highlights.
Usually above the rim highlights like
Finally,
that.
Finally, LSU Memphis, Skylar Mays destroys Mike Parks Jr. with a vicious slam.
Oh, my goodness. That's a big time dunk now.
Yeah, they don't play too much basketball down in the Bayou, but a couple of nice plays by him last night. Skylar, this one skying up. He had a nice little reverse layup, a play after this one, too.
Oh.
Yeah, we watched the sequence of videos, man. I mean, come on.
Okay.
You guys have taught me that.
Check you out, see?
All right, on to the NFL now, where it became official yesterday. Le'Veon Bell will not play football in 2018. The All-Pro running back did not report to the Steelers by 4 p.m. yesterday. That was the deadline for him to play under the franchise tag. He wanted to protect his body, to go out and get a big money deal. Now we'll see if that can happen in 2019. Here's Steelers head coach Mike Tomlin.
I understand that business is an element of the game of football, and there are elements of the game, relationships within the game, football-related relationships that we all hold near and dear and understand. And then football at this level, there's also the business element. And even when we don't understand it, we're sensitive to it. So we're not shocked when things happen from a business standpoint, no. Like I've said repeatedly, and I mean, I'm focused on the guys that are here, man. We got enough challenges that are significant in terms of meeting the things that we need to meet this week in terms of getting a win.
All right, CeCe, break down where we are right now and what the next steps are for both the Steelers and for Lev Bell.
I think the Steelers are going to move forward. Just like in any professional sports, if a guy gets injured, something happens, the team moves on. Like, players would like to think that, oh, man, the team's going to suffer. Yeah, they have one of their talented players that's not going to be there. And I believe that his history with the Pittsburgh Steelers is over with. When the coach, Mike Tomlin, tries to reach out with you multiple times, which he tried to do in L. Bell's case, and L. Bell decided that he wasn't going to respond. Mike Tomlin made that clear yesterday. He's never been involved with a player that he tried to reach out and communicate as much as he did to L. Bell and not have that player respond. We started the season with John Gruden and Khalil Mack. Oh, it was the opposite. Well, John Gruden wasn't reaching out to Khalil Mack. Now we have the opposite. Mike Tomlin wanted him there. Now, how are they going to get him signed to a long-term contract? Mike Tomlin can only have so much influence on the general manager on the organization. But I always believe, and I tell players this, you want the coaching staff speaking on your behalf. So when you cut off communication, you cut off one of the, I believe, necessary things to trying to get a deal done. Because when it comes down to it, you want someone to jump on that table and say, we need this guy here. So when L. Bell, him and his agent, decided this was the course they were going to take, I believe that they'll look back. Well, they're not going to admit it, but I believe they're going to regret this situation. Because when you walk away from $15 million as a young person, I've been through the NFL, and I've had a great post-career. It's hard to recover from $15 million. Like, you're never going to get that year back, and you're never going to get that $15 million back.
Listen, we are never going to officially know if Le'Veon Bell made the right decision or not, because we're not going to know if he was going to get hurt. Now, I know, C, your philosophy in your playing career was, if I'm supposed to get hurt, I'm going to get hurt. I'm not even going to have that in my mind. And maybe that's one of the reasons that you went through basically the entirety of your career without ever suffering a major
tell me
injury.
Tell me what other path there is. Tell me what other path there is in pro sports. Either I'm going to train my body as hard as I can and not worry about getting injuries, or what's the other? Oh, I'm going to worry about getting injuries.
Well, I think once you are playing, obviously, during the game, you shouldn't – it would be to your detriment to worry about getting hurt. Le'Veon Bell was in a specific situation where the decision was to play a season or not and to have the injury factor – have the specter of injury factor into that. But I don't think that was the only thing he was factoring into that. I think he was factoring in, do I want for the next football game I play – have the team be invested in my long-term future or just my this-year future? We're not going to know. There's no way to prove one way or another if Le'Veon Bell made the right decision or wrong decision. The only way we'll know definitively he made the wrong decision is if nobody offers him the contract he thinks he's going to get. Is if he next year signs for 2 years, $14 million, and it's like, wait, what the hell just happened? But if he gets a big deal from the Jets or the Colts or the Texans or whomever, the question will be, would he have gotten that if he played for the Steelers? Would he have not? Would he have gotten that plus the $14 million from Pittsburgh? We don't know that.
I always believe he would have gotten the money. We've seen guys who have injuries. Any other team. Like, he would have gotten the money even if he got hurt in Pittsburgh. When talented players hit free agency, they get paid. We see guys who aren't talented getting paid. Talented players hitting free agency, it's consistent. They get paid. Now, the Kaepernick thing, it was odd. The Eric Reed thing, it was odd. But the rest of the players, just look at the history. These guys get paid. They get paid, hurt or not hurt. Good players are not good players in free agency.
All right, so now you have the Steelers. They look at James Conner, and they say, okay, we got our guy. Can they use James Conner the same way they use L. Bell? Is it possible that they're going to wear him out a little too much?
Well, so listen, thus far James Conner has equaled, if not bettered, Le'Veon Bell's best year as far as through nine games.
Yeah.
He's played like a Pro Bowl, all-pro caliber running back. The only concern for me if I'm Pittsburgh in regards to James Conner specifically is the most touches he's ever had in a year of football in his life is a little over 300, 303 his sophomore year at Pitt. Obviously, last year he had almost none, and this year he's on pace for 360, and that's before you get to the playoffs. So I do think there is legitimate reason to be concerned about, will he get better as the year goes on, maintain, or will he drop off? I don't think there's any way to predict that. I don't think that we just have to see what type of player he is.
Every young running back, we make these excuses of why they're not going to be durable. Oh, once they're successful, you know what we start doing? Oh, we should monitor their carries. Well, why should we do that? Well, we don't know if he can do it in pro football, even if a guy was a workhorse. So James Conner, there's nothing he could do that would have proven. If he had 300 carries in college, we would be saying, I don't know if he could do this in pro football. So his narrative, it wouldn't have changed at all. Like, they are done with L. Bell. They're not sitting around talking about L. Bell. What they're trying to do is improve on the things that they have done through nine games. James Conner is their franchise running back. They have decided that. the conversation about L-Bell, they're over with. The Pittsburgh Steelers have moved on. And we as a show, I hope that we move on and talk about the Steelers and what right. their potential is. I wouldn't be worried. I never worry about a running back and his carries and everything, what his career is going to be. I remember this a number of years ago, DeMarco Murray. Oh, man, is he carrying the ball too much? He was having one of the greatest seasons ever. That's how you see records get broken, by pushing a guy to the threshold and seeing if he can endure, if he can't endure. There is no equation to be able to determine, will James Conner be able to continue on this pace? If L-Bell was come, if he had come back during training camp and he was right now, we'd be asking the same question.
Absolutely.
Would L-Bell be healthy during the stretch? Are they overusing
him? No. Listen, I want to make it clear. I wasn't talking about will the way the Steelers use James Conner this year affect his future. I'm saying there is, with any young running back, this is, you're correct, with any young running back, anyone who's ever, we're asking them to do something they've never done, the question is, can they do it? And that's what the Steelers now have to deal with. They're not going to be in a situation where they're going to be splitting carries. They're not going to be in a situation where he's going to go back to a backup role. He's going to have the exact role he's had through 9 games the rest of the year, and we will have the rest of the year to see if that is a workload that he can handle. Thus far, he's passed every benchmark perfectly, but we have no evidence that he can or cannot in December and into January.
All right, let's take a break. Coming up, let's talk some Cowboys. Is Dallas going to the playoffs? Pretty simple question. The answer, not that simple. Next on First Things First. Back here on First Things First, it is our favorite time of the week. 3-time Super Bowl champ Mark Schlereth joins the show. No matter what happens now, we've already won.
Now, Jim, yes. What are you going to do, though? Because yesterday, Bart what? Scott, Canty earlier in the week, yes. You had the same read. You told them
that it was a favorite.
That was like your thing. Remember that?
Yeah.
Our favorite hour of the week?
Yeah, you had to get them told on that.
Exactly.
Is not true. Okay. I changed the adjective.
Okay.
Today, you are our favorite guest.
Okay.
Today. Stink. Let's get going here. Hey, if we squint and stretch and allow ourselves to be completely open-minded, then it is possible the Dallas Cowboys are back in the playoff picture. Technically, their win Sunday night over the Eagles did put them at 4-5, tied with Philly, not far behind Washington, who sits atop the division at 6-3. So who's going to win the division? Troy Aikman has a take that may surprise you.
Right now, if I had to pick somebody, I'd pick Dallas. The Thanksgiving game is huge, but I think that if Dallas can keep it within 2 games going into Thanksgiving and then win that game, I think they're positioned pretty well. The next week or so will be interesting to see what happens.
All right, so, Stink, what exactly does Dallas have to do if they do want to do this? If they want to take the NFC East?
You watch the way they played, the way they controlled the line of scrimmage on both lines of scrimmage. We get so caught up in quarterback play. We get so caught up in, what is a guy doing throwing the ball, and how many deep shots does he take, and is he just underneath? When you dominate a line of scrimmage like they dominated the Philadelphia Eagles on both sides of the line of scrimmage, you're going to win most of your games, 85% of your games. And one of the big changes for them, they changed their left guard, their rookie left guard, struggled. Connor struggled.
Yep. He was undersized.
A little undersized. Connor Williams had the knee injury. Xavier, what's his name? Suofilo.
Yep.
He came in, former high pick by the Texans.
Right.
He came in there and absolutely struggled in the first drive and then dispensed justice. I mean, he went out there and just drove people. And they started running the ball. They had all the play action stuff. They had all the zone read stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, if they do that on a consistent basis, they can play with any team. When they show up like that and they understand that we're just going to out-hit
you. How many times, though, have you seen that happen from this team? How many times have they been able to do that?
It's been inconsistent. But a lot of times it's inconsistent because you get away from it. You get to the point where, like, there's a thing, a lot of offensive coordinators and a lot of let's just call them coaches in general, like, you don't get a lot of juice outside the facility if you're handing the ball off and you're just dominating the line of scrimmage and you're not making any specials and you're not doing...
Not in this NFL.
Right, no.
It's hard to function.
Because what ends up happening to you is you just become a guy that has, they're the best O-line in the business, and, they just can run the ball.
2 years
and,
ago.
Oh, they could just do this.
You mean, so you're saying the coordinator doesn't get credit in the media and in NFL circles for winning that way
as opposed to winning the exact way. Let me ask you this. Every guy that's coordinating right now, what's his desire?
To be a head coach.
To be a head coach. If it's the system and it's the physicality and it's the O-line and it's Zeke Elliott and you're not getting any credit for the quarterback development, how often are you going to get another opportunity when you've been a head coach before to get another head coaching job? You're not. Your name doesn't come up. It doesn't come up with the Lincoln Rileys. It doesn't come up with the other, you know, the Sean McVays back in the day, or the Matt Nagy's.
Or even Pat Shurmur, who got another chance because people saw, oh, look at what he can do with Case Keenum. Like, that was the case for him.
So the problem is what wins and what consistently wins and what will never change is dominating the line of scrimmage. But what doesn't get you a job at the next level is having your team just dominate the line of scrimmage, because you're not getting credit for that as a coordinator.
And it's about matchups. Dominating the line of scrimmage, and you got to be concerned about what you see in Washington. You cannot overcome the significant injuries that they have on their offensive line. Adrian Peterson, as we get late in the month of November, December, as those carries start to hold up, because that offense has struggled of late to be able to move the football. They tried to do everything they could to give the game away to Tampa Bay. They tried to do everything that they could.
I never seen anything like that before.
So I could understand when you look at the Cowboys, they made a change as far as their offensive line coach, made a possible change as far as the scheme, doing more combo blocks and then getting up on those linebackers, allowing them to run. Who they have and the way they're playing and who they're going to match up with, I can understand why Troy is saying that. But also Troy is saying that after he saw them beat the Eagles, so he know the head-to-head, know they play them again back at home. He knows that, oh, he skipped over the Atlanta game, so he already gave him a victory in the Atlanta game. So now they're 500. All right? So now they're 500. Get them to Thanksgiving. They have a huge advantage of playing at home on Thanksgiving. Any team that plays traditionally on Thanksgiving at home has a huge advantage over that road team that's traveling. So I could understand why he'd been like, ah, yeah, let me look down the road 2 weeks and – yeah, I could see why he would be able to pick them, because the strength of the Cowboys is one of the weaknesses that the Redskins will have.
Right. This is the case for Dallas. It's very simple. Dallas has struggled on the road all year. Their only road win was the Eagles. The rest of the year, after the Atlanta game, their only road games left are the Colts and the Giants. Like, oh, even on the road, we can beat those teams. The point two. The Washington O-line against the Dallas front, exactly the point you made. The team we're chasing, they have been devastated by injury at the spot. We might be the strongest on our team, that defensive front seven. And point three, and the one Troy didn't mention but goes unspoken with any NFC's discussion, is how many wins do you really need to win this division?
Mm-hmm.
It ain't 10. Right. I don't think so. Like, I think 9 probably gets it done. That's the case for Dallas. Here's the case against Dallas. There's only 5 teams in the conference we know they're better than. The Giants, the Lions, the Bucks, the Cards, and the Niners. Those are the only teams in the conference they have a better record than, and those are the only teams in the conference that by the eye test I can say, oh, they're clearly better than. There's 16 teams in this conference. The case against Dallas is, yeah, we can't just give them the Atlanta game. And I'm not ready to just give them the Washington game. And the week after that, they got the Saints. Like, the case against Dallas is, in 2018, passing's never been more important. Despite everything you're saying being true, it's never been more important. And they have the most limited quarterback of any team that is in the playoff discussion. The case against Dallas, to me, is an easier one to make than the case for Dallas. But I understand how you can make the case for Dallas.
Look, all I know is that we sit out here, and after every single game so far this season, we've said, well, if Dallas did this consistently, and oh, if Dallas could just do, if Zeke, if they can give Zeke 25 carries, or oh, a buck 50, that's great. Yardage for him is great. And Dak just has to throw this.
Right.
But they haven't found 2 weeks in a row where they can't even get home and away right. I mean, they're so inconsistent that I have yet to see this team put it all together more than one game at a time, which is what you'll need to do if you do want to pick up
those wins. That is true, Jenna. But we're going to have probably 2 to 4 teams in the month of November. They're going to get a little glimpse of hope, and they're going to start with injuries or what. They're going to overcome those things. Quarterbacks who aren't completing passes down the field. That's what we see every year. Teams adjust. They're through that training camp, that adjustment phase, and they get into some things that they do well. Is Dallas going to be one of those teams? That's the question. There's a bunch of teams right now, 500, one game above 500, one game under 500. But they're going to find their way and find themselves being in that playoff hunt and making that last step and getting over. Dallas will be one of those teams. They have enough good players. But we can't get distracted to think that just because they're in the playoff hunt that this is a good football team.
Exactly.
This is what...
But I think that's the thing, though. There are a lot of teams that are in the playoff hunt that aren't good football teams. There's only a few. There's only a handful of really good football teams. And I will say this. If they dominate, again, a big if they dominate line of scrimmage, Scott Linehan, you mentioned the matchups. They'll create matchups. They'll create, in that passing game, they'll create one-on-ones. If they can run the ball like that, they'll create a bunch of one-on-ones. And then it's just, can our guys beat your guys? Can you beat them? Because they'll have a bunch of different matchups that will be set within the parameters of their receiving core. There is no question they'll get one-on-ones. Can you break it? Can you break free?
And Amari Cooper has helped out that core.
Sure.
Because those guys are just role players now. They truly have a number one in Amari. And, yes, they are positioned to be able to make this push towards the end. But there are several teams that can do that also, Jenna.
All right, well, it starts with the Falcons on Sunday. Mark, stick around. Coming up, does Aaron Rodgers' playoff push begin tomorrow night? Speaking of, that's next on First Things First. Tomorrow, Aaron Rodgers and the Packers battle Russell Wilson and the Seahawks in a fierce NFC showdown. It all starts at 7:30 Eastern on Fox NFL Network and streaming on Prime Video.
Jenna, tune in at 7:30. Yours truly will be on the pregame show.
Yeah,
right here on Fox Square.
Ooh,
love it. I'm going to come just to be a member of the crowd. I'm going to hold a Chris Carter sign.
Of course you are.
Right outside Fox Square.
I'm not, but y'all look for it while I'm watching on TV.
Good looking guy is. Viral. Yeah. So when Stink is here.
Yes, exactly.
Here.
It's Stockton.
he's in the booth calling games every Sunday. And when he isn't working hard on a Sunday, he stays busy in other ways.
Oh, hey, how are you? Beautiful day here in Colorado, 60 degrees and sunny. And I know what you're thinking, and the answer is yes. I do my own yard work, of course I do. No self-respecting dude doesn't. And yeah, I am freaking yoked. Man 101, you're welcome.
Stink, I didn't know that was one of your lines. Because Stink walked into our office a couple weeks ago.
Well, that's where it became one of my lines.
Oh, okay. Yeah. You saw the reaction.
Yeah, so I was like, all right. Well, I think
you might have learned that from your dad. Because I think that's something your dad.
Oh, yeah. My dad, you know what they call my dad? Poolside.
Poolside?
Poolside. Because he's at the side of the pool doing push-ups all the time.
Really?
My dad's 79 years old, still benches 300 pounds.
Wow.
When he came into town last month and everything, you were out of the house and something came in, he was out in the back doing some work with his shirt off.
Yeah, causing a riot in the neighborhood. I was like, yeah, put a shirt on, man. Nobody wants to see that.
Stink walked into our post-show meeting wearing that exact T-shirt, sticks his head in right after his radio show ends and says, I know what y'all are thinking. I am yoked. Yeah. And walked right out.
Great mind.
My man.
No.
All right, time for stories.
How do you look better post-career than during the career?
Because I was on a strict diet of taco meat and cheese whiz when I was playing in the NFL.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Stories brought to you by the unexpected energy of ExxonMobil. Jimmy Butler met the Philadelphia media yesterday and, among other things, was asked about Markelle Fultz's shooting woes. Butler said that from what he can tell, a lot of things are mental.
Man.
Nick, what do you make of those comments? Yeah.
I mean, he's right, but that's one of those things you don't say. Hey, guys, nice to meet you. Your number one pick? Yeah, I think it's all in his head. You don't say that.
Well, the thing about it, part of the press conference, though, he was talking about in the NBA, 90% of everything you do in the NBA is confidence and it's mental. So he believes that that's what he was saying leading up to it, that, yes, a lot of it is mental because we've known him to have a great shooting stroke. But when he damaged his shoulder, there was some nerve damage, and what he has is real. Man. And will it get solved? No one knows that.
I don't know. I never seen the double clutch free throw.
I don't know. That's
he went on to make a couple after that.
Are you
that,
sure
though.
You're right-handed? Yeah, but that's what I saw.
That's Ben Simmons.
Yeah,
they got shooting problems in Philly.
Maybe switch hands.
All right, we're still in the NBA. The Rockets finally put a good one together. James Harden scored 19 of his 22 in the second half. Houston beat the Nuggets 109-99. See, is this Rockets team finally starting to turn a corner?
Oh, no, Jenna. No, they're not going to be that good. What they want to do is just try to get into the playoffs. They miss all those guys that the general manager and other Rockets fans, oh, we're not going to miss those guys. They miss them. If they are a top four seed, I'd be shocked in the West.
They seem to have, for the second time in this era, a post-Western Conference Finals hangover. The last time they made the Conference Finals and lost to the Warriors, they limped to the 8 seed the next year. They seem to be on path for the same thing this year, but yesterday was a good win. That Nuggets, by the way, 4 losses in a row, 3 losses in a row at home. That's something you're not used to seeing. Jokic got to start living up to his billing a little bit more on the offensive.
I remember when my Nuggets were 9-1.
Yeah. Long ways away.
Yeah.
Not many changes in the college football playoff rankings. In fact, the top 10 stayed exactly the same. Sting, honestly, can anyone beat Alabama?
No. You know what they do? Yeah, I mean, not that they have to recruit. You would know better than I do. I think, now this is just my theory, that they just hang around the grocery aisle where they sell razors and wait for 10-year-olds who shave, and then they just give them scholarships right then. Just like, hey, kid, you shave? Boom, scholarship. Because they're men amongst boys.
Nick Saban got on the media because he said, hey, man, every time you guys think I go to the bathroom, I do a number two. That I
get a five-star.
The result is a 5-star. Well, you know, it's close. Yeah. It's close.
I see what you're saying.
Here, well, that, I mean, that is what Saban said.
Excuse me.
Oh, God. Jenna, please read.
Anybody
finally
got a Toto?
With poor field conditions in Mexico City, the NFL has officially moved Monday night's much-anticipated matchup between the Chiefs and the Rams to Los Angeles. So, Nick, how big of a deal is home field advantage now for the Rams?
Listen, I think typically the Rams have one of the least home field advantages of any team in football because people travel to L.A. This is going to be a different circumstance because people usually plan that trip to L.A. A lot of Chiefs fans planned and Rams fans planned trips to Mexico City. Where I think this is a big deal, yeah, it favors the Rams by maybe a point more than they otherwise would be, is the NFL did the right thing here. You've got some of the bright stars of the leagues, present and future, on these two teams. And I want to see Todd Gurley or Tyreek Hill or Patrick Mahomes or any of those guys, anybody, playing on that field at Stadium Azteca.
Tell people why.
I mean, because it was a mess. I mean, it was.
Oh, no, it was a mess.
It was worse than.
It was unplayable.
It was unplayable. I know people say FedEx Field and Heinz Field. It was nothing like that.
The game was not going to go on because the players were going to refuse to play. And that's the players' right that they have being part of the union. Are you going to present me with a work environment that is conducive for me to do my job? No player is going to risk his career in Mexico. You mean we got all these great stadiums around the United States, and now the problems that we have, typically we're outside the U.S. Mexico City, we're having problems with that stadium. In London, we've had problems with their stadium because they're grass. They won't do field turf because field turf is not conducive to real football.
Right, to soccer.
And as much as they're going to play soccer in those stadiums, they keep the natural surface there, so you have problems. Every year we play there, you see footing problems with NFL. The greatest athletes in the world have problems with their footing. When you can't have proper footing, you can't do your job. There is no job. Kicking game, offense and defensive linemen, skilled guys, there is no job that you can do your job when you have a bad surface.
You know, it's interesting too on the stadiums outside of this country that focus on soccer, okay? I don't know exactly why it is, but I think they roll those fields to make sure they get true roll on the ball.
Yes.
And what ends up happening, and I played in Mexico City, that field is like, it's like a skating rink. Oh, your cleats, like they don't even sink into the turf.
Yeah, what they try to do for the soccer surface is mat it down, roll it down,
right,
where the surface is a lot tighter than a normal football
field.
But
it makes the field super hard.
It makes the bounces on the ball more true for soccer players.
And so the field is so hard that, like, I'm telling you, the footing is horrible. The game I played one in Mexico City. The footing was horrible, and I've talked to other guys who have played there that said the same thing. So there's an issue there, and obviously, you know what I mean. You say, oh, it's an advantage now for the Rams. Nobody wants to go to Mexico City to play. I'm just telling you, as a player, ain't nobody. So the Chiefs are happy about going to L.A.
And for football fans, this is, up to this point, the game of the year in the NFL. It's going to end up being one of the two or three best games or games between teams with the best record we have all year.
Build, yeah.
Now we're going to get to see it on
fair conditions. The fact that the Rams get home field advantage is their home game. They're supposed to have home field advantage. Like, I'm glad this game got moved. Now we get to see, get a good idea of who between these two teams who actually is the best.
All right, let's move on to a game where it will not be played in a place where there's bad footing. Thursday Night Football, battle of two, the NFL's best quarterbacks fighting for their playoff lives. Aaron Rodgers and the 4-4-1 Packers taking on Russell Wilson and the 4-5 Seahawks. Short week for the Pack. Coming off their win over Miami, now they head to one of the toughest places to play in Seattle. All right, Stink, which quarterback has to do more for their team to win on Thursday? Who's carrying the heavier load, Rodgers or Wilson?
Well, it's going to be Rodgers. I mean, this game is, you got to travel to Seattle. You've got to play in Seattle in that crowd noise. You've got to control the silent cadence. You've got, I mean, there's so much that you as a quarterback have to do to overcome playing on the road in Seattle. I mean, it always falls on Aaron Rodgers' shoulders, right? And I know that Jones is running the ball well. I know they've got some things going on there offensively right now. But going in that environment, you're the one. The onus is on you, especially with cadence. The only advantage you have as an offense or an offensive lineman in those situations is snap count. That's the only. I mean, we're the worst athletes on the field. So the only advantage we have is snap count. Now you take that advantage away from us on the road, and you've got to put it on Aaron Rodgers. That Aaron Rodgers has so much more on his shoulders than does Russell Wilson.
Even though, Nick, Seahawks have lost 4 of the last 5 in Seattle.
Well, listen, and that's shocking, given, I mean, even if you expect them to take a step back this year, you would expect them to hold home field advantage. But the Seahawks have the number one rushing game in football right now. They are the number one rush offense in football. They just put up 270 on the Rams. 270 and a loss to the Rams. They were down 12 points with 5 minutes left and still running the football. Like, I will give them credit. Ever since Marshawn Lynch left, they had struggled to find a running game. This year, they seem to have found one. Now, the Packers this past week, Aaron Jones had the best game of his career. They are finding a running game as well. But I agree with Stink. I think that in this specific game and these two teams in totality, Rodgers is asked and needed to do more than Russell Wilson, even though historically a ton for the Seahawks to move the ball has been on Russell Wilson's shoulders.
What I've seen from the Saints and what they did last week against the Rams, very impressive. To me, the running game is about resolve. It's not about who's got the better personnel. It's about resolve that I'm going to run the ball today. There's not a front. There's not anything you're going to do to stop me from running that. If the Packers, when they get off the bus, their offensive coordinator, if they decide to do that and support Aaron Rodgers the way they did last week. Aaron Jones, like, that's what they have to be able to do. I just believe that Seattle is more committed to doing it. I've seen this season. They're trying to transfer from being a Russell just make plays and trying to present a running game to them. So for me, I believe the pressure will be put back on Aaron Rodgers because that's what we've seen. They get down, they get in the game, and now it's Aaron, bring us back. Aaron makes some magic. Right. So Aaron's going to have to do more.
By the way, two of those losses at home, one to the Rams, pretty good.
2-point loss.
One to the Chargers, lost it on the very last play of the game. So, I mean, two really good teams that came into Seattle and beat them. And I think you have to understand, you know, as much of a transition has gone on, you talk about the running game in Seattle, that transition on defense is real. I mean, talking about all four guys in that defensive secondary are four different dudes from the Legion of Boom just a few years ago. You know, your linebacker Bobby Wagner is the one constant on that team. Frank Clark is a really good player, but he doesn't have anybody on the other edge really taking control. Mebane is now playing for the Chargers. I mean, there has been a lot of guys that have left there, and they're trying to rebuild that and trying to reestablish themselves as a dominant defense, and that takes time.
Which team do you trust more if they got into the playoffs? Because you may think Seattle's playing a better game. You'd play the Packers.
The Packers. And is it because if they get into the playoffs, I trust the Packers more. Because if either of these teams gets in, obviously they're going to have to be very hot going in because they're going to have to win something like 6 of 7 down the stretch. But if the Packers get in, they're the team I trust more. They have been very good this year at getting to the quarterback. If they get in, it will mean Aaron Jones has continued on this stretch. And obviously they have Aaron Rodgers. For all those reasons, the Packers would be the team that if they get in, I trust more.
Yeah, if you get to 4-4-1, you're at 4-5, it's hard to get some trust. But you have to pick one of them. It's Seattle, they're not playing well at home, even though those two losses are very, very difficult.
Seattle, man, since Pete Carroll's been there, they've been either 8-0 or 7-1 at home.
At home.
And then now they lose that.
Yeah.
They've been barely a 500 club, even in their Super Bowl years with Pete Carroll there. So I got to say, I trust the pack. I don't trust neither one of them. But the pack, the cheeseheads would get it.
Yeah, and I'm the same. I would go with the Packers. I'd go with Aaron Rodgers. And they're going to get, you know, the thing about playing youth early is eventually late, guess what they start to do? They start to mature and start to understand it. In that receiving core, you know, with Cobb being out and injured, and they've had a lot of different machinations of players that have played a lot.
Equanimeous St. Brown, Valdez, Scantling.
Yeah, they're going to start to play. Those guys were going to get more and more experience toward the end of the season when you have to make that push, you know, in the last 4 weeks of the season.
The only thing I worry about with young receivers, man, when it gets real cold in Green Bay, man, you need veteran guys who are used to it. Young guys, let me see them do it. Let me see Donald Driver. Let me see Greg Jennings. Man, let me see. These guys came through. When the Packers are good, they're wide receivers. I'm talking about sub-zero. They make some unbelievable catches. Jordy Nelson, can they do that? Now, that right there is something I got to see.
Thank you for listening to the First Things First podcast. Remember, leave us a review and tell us what you think. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and catch us on FS1 Monday through Friday, 6:30 a.m. Eastern. For Chris Carter and Nick Wright, I'm Jenna Wolf. So long, everybody.